Recorded Books Incorporated presents an unabridged recording of Something Wicked This Way Comes by Ray Bradbury, narrated by Paul Hecht. This work is copyrighted 1962-1997 by Ray Bradbury. This recording is copyrighted 1999 by Recorded Books Incorporated. The carnival rolls in sometime after midnight, ushering in Halloween a week early. The shrill siren song of the calliope beckons to all with a seductive promise of dreams and youth regained. But in reality, this is a season of dying. And Cooper and Dark's pandemonium shadow show has come to Greentown, Illinois, to destroy every life touched by its strange and sinister mystery. And now, Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Prologue. First of all, it was October, a rare month for boys. Not that all months aren't rare, but there be bad and good, as the pirates say. Take September, a bad month. School begins. Consider August, a good month. School hasn't begun yet. July? Well, July is really fine. There's no chance in the world for school. June, no doubting it. June's best of all, for the school doors spring wide and September's a billion years away. But you take October now. School's been on a month, and you're riding easier in the rains, jogging along. You got time to think of the garbage you'll dump on old man Prickett's porch, or the hairy ape costume you'll wear to the YMCA the last night of the month. And if it's around October 20th and everything's smoky-smelling in the sky orange and ash-gray at twilight, it seems Halloween will never come in a fall of broomsticks and a soft flap of bedsheets around corners. But one strange, wild, dark, long year, Halloween came early. One year, Halloween came on October 24th, 3 hours after midnight. At that time, James Nightshade of 97 Oak Street was 13 years, 11 months, 23 days old. Next door, William Halloway was 13 years, 11 months, and 24 days old. Both touched toward 14. It almost trembled in their hands. And that was the October week when they grew up overnight and were never so young any more. Part 1. Arrivals. Chapter 1. The seller of lightning rods arrived just ahead of the storm. He came along the street of Greentown, Illinois, in the late cloudy October day, sneaking glances over his shoulder. Somewhere not so far back, vast lightning stomped the earth. Somewhere a storm like a great beast with terrible teeth could not be denied. So the salesman jangled and clanged his huge leather kit, in which oversized puzzles of ironmongery lay unseen, but which his tongue conjured from door to door, until he came at last to a lawn, which was cut all wrong. No, not the grass. The salesman lifted his gaze. But two boys, far up the gentle slope, lying on the grass. Of a like size and general shape, the boys sat carving twig whistles, talking of olden or future times, content with having left their fingerprints on every movable object in Greentown during summer past, and their footprints on every open path between here and the lake, and there and the river since school began. "Howdy, boys," called the man, all dressed in storm-colored clothes. "Folks home?" The boys shook their heads. "Got any money yourselves?" The boys shook their heads. "Well..." The salesman walked about 3 feet, stopped and hunched his shoulders. Suddenly he seemed aware of house windows or the cold sky staring at his neck. He turned slowly, sniffing the air. Wind rattled the empty trees. Sunlight, breaking through a small rift in the clouds, minted a last few oak leaves all gold. But the sun vanished, the coins were spent, the air blew gray. The salesman shook himself from the spell. The salesman edged slowly up the lawn. "Boy," he said, "what's your name?" And the first boy, with hair as blonde-white as milk thistle, shut up one eye, tilted his head, and looked at the salesman with a single eye, as open, bright, and clear as a drop of summer rain. "Will," he said. "William Halloway." The storm gentleman turned. "And you?" The second boy didn't move, but lay stomach down on the autumn grass, debating as if he might make up a name. His hair was wild, thick, and the glossy color of wax chestnuts. His eyes, fixed to some distant point within himself, were mint, rock-crystal green. At last he put a blade of dry grass in his casual mouth. "Jim Nightshade," he said. The storm salesman nodded, as if he had known it all along.
"Nightshade, that's quite a name."
"And only fitting," said Will Halloway. "I was born 1 minute before midnight, October 30th. Jim was born 1 minute after midnight, which makes it October 31st.
"Halloween," said Jim.
By their voices, the boys had told the tale all their lives, proud of their mothers living house next to house, running for the hospital together, bringing sons into the world seconds apart, one light, one dark. There was a history of mutual celebration behind them. Each year, Will lit the candles on a single cake at 1 minute to midnight, Jim at 1 minute after, where the last day of the month begun, blew them out. So much, Will said, excitedly, so much Jim agreed to, silently. So much the salesman, running before the storm, but poised here uncertainly, heard, looking from face to face.
"Halloway? Nightshade. No money, you say?"
The man, grieved by his own conscientiousness, rummaged in his leathery bag and seized forth an iron contraption.
"Take this, free. Why? One of those houses will be struck by lightning. Without this rod, bang! Fire and ash, roast pork and cinders. Grab!"
The salesman released the rod. Jim didn't move, but Will caught the iron and gasped. "Boy, it's heavy and funny-looking. Never seen a lightning rod like this. Look, Jim!" And Jim, at last, stretched like a cat and turned his head. His green eyes got big and then very narrow. The metal thing was hammered and shaped, half-crescent, half-cross. Around the rim of the main rod, little curlicues and doohinges had been soldered on later. The entire surface of the rod was finely scratched and etched with strange languages, names that could tie the tongue or break the jaw. Numerals that added to incomprehensible sums, pictographs of insect animals all bristle, chaff, and claw.
"That's Egyptian."
Jim pointed his nose at a bug soldered to the iron.
"Scarab beetle."
"So it is, boy."
Jim squinted.
"And those there, Phoenician hen tracks."
"Right."
"Why?" asked Jim.
"Why?" said the man. "Why, the Egyptian, Arabic, Abyssinian, Choctaw? Well, what tongue does the wind talk? What nationality is a storm? What country do rains come from? What color is lightning? Where does thunder go when it dies? Boys, you gotta be ready in every dialect, with every shape and form, to hex the St. Elmo's fires, the balls of blue light that prowl the earth like sizzling cats. I got the only lightning rods in the world that hear, feel, know, and sass back any storm, no matter what tongue, voice, or sign. No foreign thunder so loud this rod can't soft-talk it."
But Will was staring beyond the man now.
"Which," he said, "which house will it strike?"
"Which? Hold on. Wait."
The salesmen search deep in their faces.
Some folks draw lightning, suck it like cats suck baby's breath. Some folks' polarities are negative, some positive, some glow in the dark, some snuff out. You now, the two of you, I...
What makes you so sure lightning will strike anywhere around here? Said Jim suddenly, his eyes bright. The salesman almost flinched.
Why, I got a nose, an eye, an ear. Both those houses, they're timbers. Listen.
They listened. Maybe their houses leaned under the cool afternoon wind. Maybe not.
Lightning needs channels like rivers to run in. One of those attics is a dry river bottom itching to let lightning pour through. Tonight.
Tonight? Jim sat up happily.
No ordinary storm, said the salesman. Tom Fury tells you. Fury, ain't that a fine name for one who sells lightning rods? Did I take the name? No. Did the name fire me to my occupations? Yes. Grown up, I saw cloudy fires jumping the world, making men hop and hide. Thought, I'll chart hurricanes, map storms, and run ahead, shaking my iron cudgels, my miraculous defenders in my fists. I've shielded and made snug, safe 100,000, count 'em, God-fearing homes. So when I tell you, boys, you're in dire need, listen. Climb that roof, nail this rod high, ground it in the good earth before nightfall.
But which house? Which? Asked Will. The salesman reared off, blew his nose in a great kerchief, then walked slowly across the lawn as if approaching a huge time bomb that ticked silently there. He touched Will's front porch newels, ran his hand over a post of floorboard, then shut his eyes and leaned against the house to let its bones speak to him. Then, hesitant, he made his cautious way to Jim's house next door. Jim stood up to watch. The salesman put his hand out to touch, to stroke, to quiver his fingertips on the old paint.
This, he said at last, is the one.
Jim looked proud. Without looking back, the salesman said, Jim Nightshade, this your place?
Mine, said Jim. I should have known, said the man.
Hey, what about me? Said Will. The salesman snuffed again at Will's house.
No, no. Oh, a few sparks'll jump on your rain spouts, but the real show's next door here, at the Nightshades.
Well, the salesman hurried back across the lawn to seize his huge leather bag.
I'm on my way. Storm's coming. Don't wait, Jim boy, otherwise, bam! You'll be found, your nickels, dimes, and Indian heads fused by electroplating. Abe Lincoln's melted into Miss Columbia's. Eagles plucked raw on the backs of quarters. All run to quicksilver in your jeans. More. Any boy hit by lightning, lift his lid, and there on his eyeball, pretty as the Lord's Prayer on a pin, find the last scene the boy ever saw. A box brownie photo, by God, of that fire climbing down the sky to blow you like a penny whistle. Suck your soul back up along the bright stair. Get, boy, hammer it high, or you're dead come dawn.
And jangling his case full of iron rods, the salesman wheeled about and charged down the walk, blinking wildly at the sky, the roof, the trees, at last closing his eyes, moving, sniffing, muttering.
Yes, bad. Here it comes. Feel it. Way off now, but running fast.
And the man in the storm-dark clothes was gone, his cloud-colored hat pulled down over his eyes, and the trees rustled, and the sky seemed very old suddenly, and Jim and Will stood testing the wind to see if they could smell electricity, the lightning rod fallen between them.
Jim, said Will, don't stand there. Your house, he said. You going to nail up the rod, or ain't you?
No, smiled Jim. Why spoil the fun?
Fun, you crazy? I'll get the ladder, you the hammer, some nails and wire.
But Jim didn't move. Will broke and ran. He came back with a ladder.
Jim, think of your mom. You want her burnt?
Will climbed the side of the house alone and looked down. Slowly, Jim moved to the ladder below and started up. Thunder sounded far off in the cloud-shadowed hills. The air smelled fresh and raw on top of Jim Nightshade's roof. Even Jim admitted that.
Chapter 2. There's nothing in the living world like books on water cures, deaths of a thousand slices, or pouring white-hot lava off castle walls on drolls and mountebanks. So, said Jim Nightshade, that's all he read. If it wasn't how to burgle the First National, it was how to build catapults or shape black bumbershoots into lurking bat costumes for cabbage night. Jim breathed it out all fine, and Will, he breathed it in. With the lightning rod nailed to Jim's roof, Will proud and Jim ashamed of what he considered mutual cowardice, it was late in the day. Supper over, it was time for their weekly jog to the library. Like all boys, they never walked anywhere, but named a goal and lit for it, scissors and elbows. Nobody won. Nobody wanted to win. It was in their friendship. They just wanted to run forever, shadow and shadow. Their hands slapped library door handles together, their chests broke track tapes together, their tennis shoes beat parallel pony tracks over lawns, trimmed bushes, squirreled trees, no one losing, both winning, thus saving their friendship for other times of loss. So it was on this night that blew warm, then cool, as they let the wind take them downtown at 8 o'clock. They felt the wings on their fingers and elbows flying, then suddenly plunged in new sweeps of air. The clear autumn river flung them headlong where they must go. Up steps 3, 6, 9, 12, slap, their palms hit the library door. Jim and Will grinned at each other. It was all so good, these blowing quiet October nights. And the library waiting inside now with its green-shaded lamps and papyrus dust. Jim listened. What's that?
What? The wind?
Like music.
Jim squinted at the horizon.
Don't hear no music.
Jim shook his head. Gone, or it wasn't even there. Come on. They opened the door and stepped in. They stopped. The library deeps lay waiting for them. Out in the world, not much happened. But here, in the special night, a land bricked with paper and leather, anything might happen, always did. Listen, and you heard 10,000 people screaming so high only dogs feathered their ears. 1 million folk ran toting cannons, sharpening guillotines. Chinese, four abreast, marched on, forever, invisible, silent, yes, but Jim and Will had the gift of ears and noses as well as the gift of tongues. This was a factory of spices from far countries. Here, alien deserts slumbered. Up front was the desk, where the nice old lady, Miss Watrous, purple-stamped your books, but down off away were Tibet and Antarctica, the Congo. There went Miss Wills, the other librarian, through Outer Mongolia, calmly toting fragments of Peiping and Yokohama and the Celebes. Way down the third book corridor, an oldish man whispered his broom along in the dark, mounding the fallen spices. Will stared. It was always a surprise. That old man, his work, his name. That's Charles William Halloway, thought Will. Not grandfather, not far-wandering ancient uncle, as some might think, but my father.
So, looking back down the corridor, was Dad shocked to see he owned a son who visited this separate 20,000 fathoms deep world?
Dad always seemed stunned when Will rose up before him as if they had met a lifetime ago, and one had grown old while the other stayed young. And this fact stood between... Far off, the old man smiled.
They approached each other carefully.
"Is that you, Will? Grown an inch since this morning?"
Charles Halloway shifted his gaze.
"Jim? Eyes darker, cheeks paler, you burn yourself at both ends, Jim?"
"Heck," said Jim.
"No such place as heck, but hell's right here under A for Alighieri."
"Allegory's beyond me," said Jim.
"How stupid of me," Dad laughed. "I mean Dante. Look at this. Pictures by Mr. Doré showing all the aspects. Hell never looked better. Here's souls sunk to their gills in slime. There's someone upside down, wrong side out. Boy, howdy."
Jim eyed the pages two different ways and thumbed on. "Got any dinosaur pictures?" Dad shook his head.
"It's over in the next aisle."
He strolled them around and reached out.
"Here we are. Pterodactyl, Kite of Destruction. Or what about Drums of Doom, the Saga of the Thunder Lizards? Pep you up, Jim?"
"I'm pepped."
Dad winked at Will. Will winked back. They stood now. A boy with corn-colored hair and a man with moon-white hair. A boy with a summer apple, a man with a winter apple face.
"Dad. Dad," thought Will. Why, he looks like me in a smashed mirror."
And suddenly Will remembered nights rising at 2 in the morning to go to the bathroom and spying across town to see that one single light in the high library window, and knowing Dad had lingered on late, murmuring and reading alone under these green jungle lamps. It made Will sad and funny to see that light, to know the old man. He stopped to change the word. His father was here in all this shadow.
"Will," said the old man, who was also a janitor, who happened to be his father, "what about you?"
"Huh?"
Will shook himself.
"You need a white hat or a black hat book?"
"Hats," said Will.
"Well, Jim."
They perambulated, Dad running his fingers along the book spines.
"He wears the black 10-gallon hats and reads books to fit. Middle name's Moriarty, right, Jim? Any day now he'll move up from Fu Manchu to Machiavelli here. Medium size, dark fedora. Or over along to Dr. Faustus, extra-large black Stetson. That leaves the white hat boys to you, Will. Here's Gandhi, next door is St. Thomas, and on the next level, well, Buddha."
"You don't mind," said Will. "I'll settle for the mysterious island."
"What," asked Jim, scowling, "is all this talk about white and black hats?"
"Why," Dad handed Jules Verne to Will, "it's just a long time ago I had to decide myself which color I'd wear."
"So," said Jim, "which did you pick?"
Dad looked surprised. Then he laughed, uneasily.
"Since you need to ask, Jim, you make me wonder. Will, tell Mom I'll be home soon. Get out of here, both of you. Miss Watrous," he called softly to the librarian at the desk, "Dinosaurs and Mysterious Islands coming up."
The door slammed. Outside, a weather of stars ran clear in an ocean sky.
"Heck,"
Jim sniffed north. Jim sniffed south.
"Where's the storm? That darn salesman promised. I just got to watch that lightning fizz down my drain pipes."
Will let the wind ruffle and refit his clothes, his skin, his hair. Then he said faintly,
"It'll be here. By morning."
"Who says?"
"The huckleberries all down my arms, they say."
"Great."
The wind flew Jim away. A similar kite, Will swooped to follow. Chapter 3. Watching the boys vanish away, Charles Halloway suppressed a sudden urge to run with them, make the pack. He knew what the wind was doing to them, where it was taking them, to all the secret places that were never so secret again in life. Somewhere in him a shadow turned mournfully over. You had to run with a night like this so the sadness couldn't hurt.
Look, he thought, Will runs because running is its own excuse. Jim runs because something's up ahead of him. Yet, strangely, they do run together. What's the answer? He wondered, walking through the library, putting out the lights, putting out the lights, putting out the lights. Is it all in the whorls, on our thumbs and fingers? Why are some people all grasshopper fiddlings, scrapings, all antennae shivering, one big ganglion eternally knotting, slip-knotting, square-knotting themselves? They stoke a furnace all their lives, sweat their lips, shine their eyes, and start it all in the crib. Caesar's lean and hungry friends, they eat the dark who only stand and breathe. That's Jim, all bramble hair and itchweed. And Will? Why, he's the last peach high on a summer tree. Some boys walk by and you cry seeing them. They feel good, they look good, they are good. Oh, they're not above peeing off a bridge or stealing an occasional dime store pencil sharpener. It's not that. It's just, you know, seeing them pass. That's how they'll be all their life. They'll get hit, hurt, cut, bruised, and always wonder, why? Why does it happen? How can it happen to them? But Jim now, he knows it happens. He watches for it happening. He sees it start. He sees it finish. He licks the wound he expected and never asks why. He knows. He always knew. Someone knew before him a long time ago. Someone who had wolves for pets and lions for night conversants. Hell, Jim doesn't know with his mind, but his body knows. And while Will's putting a bandage on his latest scratch, Jim's ducking, weaving, bouncing away from the knockout blow which must inevitably come. So there they go, Jim running slower to stay with Will, Will running faster to stay with Jim. Jim breaking two windows in a haunted house because Will's along, Will breaking one window instead of none because Jim's watching. God, how we get our fingers in each other's clay! That's friendship, each playing the potter to see what shapes we can make of the other. Jim, Will, he thought, strangers. Go on, I'll catch up, some day. The library door gasped open, slammed. 5 minutes later he turned into the corner saloon for his nightly one and only drink, in time to hear a man say, I read when alcohol was invented, the Italians thought it was the big thing they'd been looking for centuries. The elixir of life, did you know that? No, the bartender's back was turned. Sure, the man went on. Distilled wine, 9th, 10th century. Looked like water, but it burnt. I mean, it not only burnt the mouth and stomach, but you could set it on fire. So they thought they'd mixed water and fire. Fire water, the elixir vitae. By God, maybe they weren't so far wrong, thinking it was the cure-all, the thing that worked miracles. Have a drink. I don't need it, said Halloway, but someone inside me does. Who? The boy I once was, thought Halloway, who runs like the leaves down the sidewalk autumn nights. But he couldn't say that. So he drank, eyes shut, listening to hear if that thing inside turned over again, rustling in the deep bonds that were stacked for burning, but never burned. Chapter 4. Will stopped. Will looked at the Friday night town. It seemed when the first stroke of 9 banged from the big courthouse clock, all the lights were on and business humming in the shops. But by the time the last stroke of 9 shook everyone's fillings in his teeth, the barbers had yanked off the sheets, powdered the customers, trotted them forth. The druggist's fount had stopped fizzing like a nest of snakes. The insect neons everywhere had ceased buzzing, and the vast, glittering acreage of the dime store with its 10 billion metal, glass, and paper oddments waiting to be fished over suddenly blacked out. Shades slithered, doors boomed, keys rattled their bones in locks. People fled with hordes of torn newspaper mice nibbling their heels. Bang! They were gone.
boy!" yelled Will. "Folks run like they thought the storm was here."
"It is!" shouted Jim. "Us!"
They stomped, pound, thundered over iron grate steel trapdoors, past a dozen unlit shops, a dozen half-lit, a dozen dying dark. The city was dead as they rounded the United Cigar Store corner to see a wooden Cherokee glide in darkness by himself.
"Hey!"
Mr. Tetley, the proprietor, peered over the Indian's shoulder.
"Scare you, boys?"
"Nah." But Will shivered, feeling cold tidal waves of strange rain moving down the prairie as on a deserted shore. When the lightning nailed the town, he wanted to be layered under 16 blankets and a pillow.
"Mr. Tetley?" said Will quietly.
For now, there were two wooden Indians upright in ripe tobacco darkness. Mr. Tetley, amidst his jest, had frozen, mouth open, listening.
"Mr. Tetley?"
He heard something far away on the wind, but couldn't say what it was. The boys backed off. He didn't see them. He didn't move. He only listened. They left him. They ran. In the fourth empty block from the library, the boys came upon a third wooden Indian, Mr. Crosetti, in front of his barber shop. His door key in his trembling fingers didn't see them stop.
What had stopped them?
A teardrop. It moved, shining down Mr. Crosetti's left cheek. He breathed heavily.
"Crosetti, you fool, something happens, nothing happens, you cry like a baby."
Mr. Crosetti took a trembling breath, snuffing.
"Don't you smell it?"
Jim and Will sniffed.
"Licorice?" "Heck no. Cotton candy."
"I haven't smelled that in years," said Mr. Crosetti.
Jim snorted. "It's around."
"Yes, but who notices? When? Now my nose tells me breathe, and I'm crying. Why? Because I remember how a long time ago boys ate that stuff. Why haven't I stopped to think and smell the last 30 years?
"You're busy, Mr. Crosetti," Will said. "You haven't got time."
"Time, time!" Mr. Crosetti wiped his eyes. "Where does that smell come from? There's no place in town sells cotton candy, only circuses."
"Hey," said Will, "that's right."
"Well, Crosetti is done crying."
The barber blew his nose and turned to lock his shop door. As he did this, Will watched the barber pole whirl its red serpentine up out of nothing, leading his gaze around, rising to vanish into more nothing.
On countless noons, Will had stood here, trying to unravel that ribbon, watch it come, go, end without ending.
Mr. Crosetti put his hand to the light switch under the spinning pole.
"Don't," said Will,
then murmuring, "don't turn it off." Mr. Crosetti looked at the pole as if freshly aware of its miraculous properties. He nodded gently, his eyes soft.
"Where does it come from? Where does it go, eh? Who knows? Not you, not him, not me. Oh, the mysteries, by God. So, we'll leave it on."
"It's good to know," thought Will. "It'll be running until dawn, winding up from nothing, winding away to nothing while we sleep.
Good night, good night."
And they left him behind in a wind that very faintly smelled of licorice and cotton candy. Chapter 5. Charles Halloway put his hand to the saloon's double swing doors, hesitant, as if the gray hairs on the back of his hand, like antennae, had felt something beyond slide by in the October night. Perhaps great fires burned somewhere and their furnace blasts warned him not to step forth. Or another ice age had loomed across the land. Its freezing bulk might already have laid waste 1 billion people in the hour. Perhaps time itself was draining off down an immense glass with powdered darkness falling after to bury all. Or maybe it was only that man in a dark suit, seen through the saloon window across the street. Great paper rolls under one arm, a brush and bucket in his free hand. The man was whistling a tune very far away.
It was a tune from another season, one that never ceased making Charles Halloway sad when he heard it. The song was incongruous for October, but immensely moving, overwhelming, no matter what day or what month it was sung. I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet their words repeat of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Charles Halloway shivered. Suddenly there was the old sense of terrified elation, of wanting to laugh and cry together when he saw the innocence of the earth wandering the snowy streets the day before Christmas, among all the tired men and women whose faces were dirty with guilt, unwashed of sin, and smashed like small windows by life that hit without warning, ran, hid, came back, and hit again. Then pealed the bells more loud and deep. God is not dead, nor doth he sleep. The wrong shall fail, the right prevail, with peace on earth, goodwill to men. The whistling died. Charles Halloway stepped out. Far up ahead, the man who had whistled the tune was motioning his arms by a telegraph pole, silently working. Now he vanished into the open door of a shop. Charles Halloway, not knowing why, crossed the street to watch the man pasting up one of the posters inside the unrented and empty store. Now the man stepped out the door with his brush, his paste bucket, his rolled papers. His eyes, a fierce and lustful shine, fixed on Charles Halloway. Smiling, he gestured, an open hand. Halloway stared. The palm of that hand was covered with fine, black, silken hair. It looked like... The hand clenched, tight. It waved. The man swept around the corner. Charles Halloway, stunned, flushed with sudden summer heat, swayed, then turned to gaze into the empty shop. Two sawhorses stood parallel to each other under a single spotlight. Placed over these two sawhorses like a funeral of snow and crystal was a block of ice 6 feet long. It shone dimly with its own effulgence, and its color was light green-blue. It was a great cool gem resting there in the dark. On a little white placard, at one side near the window, the following calligraphic message could be read by lamplight. Cougar and Dark's Pandemonium Shadow Show, Fantoccini Marionette Circus, and your Plain Meadow Carnival, arriving immediately. Here on display, one of our many attractions, the most beautiful woman in the world. Halloway's eyes leaped to the poster on the inside of the window. The most beautiful woman in the world. And back to the cold, long block of ice. It was such a block of ice as he remembered from traveling magicians' shows when he was a boy, when the local ice company contributed a chunk of winter in which, for 12 hours on end, frost maidens lay embedded, on display, while people watched, and comedies toppled down the raw white screen, and coming attractions came and went, and at last the pale ladies slid forth, all rhymed, chipped free by perspiring sorcerers to be led off smiling into the dark. Behind the curtains. The most beautiful woman in the world. And yet, this vast chunk of wintry glass held nothing but frozen river water. No, not quite empty. Halloway felt his heart pound one special time. Within the huge winter gem, was there not a special vacuum, a voluptuous hollow, a prolonged emptiness which undulated from tip to toe of the ice? And wasn't this vacuum, this emptiness, waiting to be filled with summer flesh? Was it not shaped somewhat like a woman? Yes. The ice. And the lovely hollows, the horizontal flow of emptiness within the ice. The lovely nothingness, the exquisite flow of an invisible mermaid daring the ice to capture it. The ice was cold. The emptiness within the ice was warm. He wanted to go away from here, but Charles Halloway stood in the strange night for a long time, looking in at the empty shop
and the two sawhorses, and the cold, waiting Arctic coffin set there like a vast star of India in the dark. Chapter 6 Jim Nightshade stopped at the corner of Hickory and Main, breathing easily, his eyes fixed tenderly on the leafy darkness of Hickory Street. Will?
No.
Will stopped, surprised at his own violence. It's just there, the fifth house. Just 1 minute, Will. Jim pleaded softly.
Minute?
Will glanced down the street, which was the street of the theater. Until this summer, it had been an ordinary street where they stole peaches, plums, and apricots, each in its day. But late in August, while they were monkey-climbing for the sourest apples, the thing happened which changed the houses, the taste of the fruit, and the very air within the gossiping trees.
"Will, it's waiting. Maybe something's happening," hissed Jim.
"Maybe something is." Will swallowed hard and felt Jim's hand pinch his arm. For it was no longer the street of the apples or plums or apricots. It was the one house with a window at the side, and this window, Jim said, was a stage, with a curtain, the shade, that is, up. And in that room on that strange stage were the actors, who spoke mysteries, mouthed wild things, laughed, sighed, murmured so much of it was whispers Will did not understand.
"Just one last time, Will."
"You know it won't be last." Jim's face was flushed, his cheeks blazing, his eyes green glass fire. He thought of that night, them picking the apples, Jim suddenly crying softly. "Oh, there." And Will, hanging to the limbs of the tree, tight-pressed, terribly excited, staring in at the theater, that peculiar stage where people, all unknowing, flourished shirts above their heads, let fall clothes to the rug, stood raw and animal-crazy, naked like shivering horses, hands out to touch each other.
"What are they doing?" thought Will. "Why are they laughing? What's wrong with them? What's wrong?"
He wished the light would go out. But he hung tight to the suddenly slippery tree and watched the bright window theater, heard the laughing, and numb at last let go, slid, fell, lay dazed, then stood in dark, gazing up at Jim, who still clung to his high limb. Jim's face, hearth-flushed, cheeks fire-fuzzed, lips parted, stared in.
"Jim, Jim, come down!"
But Jim didn't hear.
"Jim!"
And when Jim looked down at last, he saw Will as a stranger below, with some silly request to give off living and come down to earth. So Will ran off, alone, thinking too much, thinking nothing at all, not knowing what to think.
"Will, please."
Will looked at Jim now, with the library books in his hands.
"We've been to the library, ain't that enough?"
Jim shook his head.
"Carry these for me."
He handed Will his books and trotted softly off under the hissing, whispering trees.
"Three houses down," he called back. "Will, know what you are? A darn old dimwit Episcopal Baptist."
Then Jim was gone. Will seized the books tight to his chest. They were wet from his hands. "Don't look back," he thought. "I won't, I won't." And looking only toward home, he walked that way, quickly. Chapter 7 Halfway home, Will felt a shadow breathing hard behind him.
"Theater closed?" said Will, not looking back.
Jim walked in silence beside him for a long while and then said,
"Nobody home."
"Swell." Jim spat.
"Darn Baptist preacher, you!"
And around the corner a tumbleweed slithered, a great cotton ball of pale paper which bounced, then clung shivering to Jim's legs. Will grabbed the paper, laughing, pulled it off, let it fly. He stopped laughing. The boys, watching the pale throwaway rattle and flit through the trees, were suddenly cold.
"Wait a minute," said Jim slowly.
All of a sudden, they were yelling, running, leaping. "Don't tear it! Careful!" The paper fluttered like a snare drum in their hands. Coming October 24th. Their lips moved, shadowing the words set in Rococo type. Cougar and Dark's Carnival. October 24th, that's tomorrow. It can't be, said Will. All carnivals stop after Labor Day. Who cares? 1001 Wonders. See? Mephistopheles, the Lava Drinker, Mr. Electrico, the Monster Montgolfier. Balloon, said Will. A Montgolfier is a balloon. Mademoiselle Tarot, read Jim. The Dangling Man, the Demon Guillotine, the Illustrated Man. Hey, that's just an old guy with tattoos. No. Jim breathed warm on the paper. He's illustrated. Special. See? Covered with monsters. A menagerie. Jim's eyes jumped. See? The skeleton. Ain't that fine, Will? Not thin man, no, but skeleton. See the dust witch. What's a dust witch, Will? Dirty old gypsy. No. Jim squinted off, seeing things. A gypsy that was born in the dust, raised in the dust, and someday winds up back in the dust. Here's more. Egyptian mirror maze. See yourself 10,000 times. St. Anthony's Temple of Temptation. The most beautiful, read Will, woman in the world, finished Jim. They looked at each other. Can a carnival have the most beautiful woman on earth in its sideshow, Will? You ever seen carnival ladies, Jim? Grizzly bears. But how come this handbill claims... Oh, shut up. You mad at me, Will? No, it's just... Get it! The wind had torn the paper from their hands. The handbill blew over the trees and away in an idiot caper. Gone. It's not true, anyway, Will gasped. Carnivals don't come this late in the year. Silly, darn-sounding thing. Who'd go to it? Me. Jim stood quiet in the dark. Me, thought Will, seeing the guillotine flash, the Egyptian mirrors unfold accordions of light and the sulfur-skinned devil man sipping lava like gunpowder tea. That music, Jim murmured. Calliope must be coming tonight. Carnivals come at sunrise. Yeah. But what about the licorice and cotton candy we smelled close? And Will thought of the smells and the sounds flowing on the river of wind from beyond the darkening houses. Mr. Tetley listening by his wooden Indian friend, Mr. Crozetti with a single tear shining down his cheek, and the barber pole sliding its red tongue up and around forever out of nowhere and away to eternity. Will's teeth chattered. Let's go home. "We are home!" cried Jim, surprised. For not knowing it, they had reached their separate houses and now moved up separate walks. On his porch, Jim leaned over and called softly. "Will, you're not mad?" "Heck no! We won't go by that street, that house, the theater again for a month, a year, I swear!"
"Sure, Jim, sure."
They stood with their hands on the doorknobs of their houses, and Will looked up at Jim's roof, where the lightning rod glittered against the cold stars. The storm was coming. The storm wasn't coming. No matter which, he was glad Jim had that grand contraption up there.
Night.
Night. Their separate doors slammed. Chapter 8. Will opened the door and shut it again, quietly this time.
"That's better," said his mother's voice.
Framed through the hall door, Will saw the only theater he cared for now, the familiar stage where sat his father, home already, he and Jim must have run the long way round, holding a book but reading the empty spaces. In a chair by the fire, Mother knitted and hummed like a tea kettle. He wanted to be near and not near them. He saw them close, he saw them far. Suddenly they were awfully small in too large a room in too big a town and much too huge a world. In this unlocked place, they seemed at the mercy of anything that might break in from the night. Including me, Will thought. Including me. Suddenly, he loved them more for their smallness than he ever had when they seemed tall. His mother's fingers twitched, her mouth counted, the happiest woman he had ever seen. He remembered a greenhouse on a winter day, pushing aside thick jungle leaves to find a creamy pink hothouse rose poised alone in the wilderness. That was Mother, smelling like fresh milk, happy to herself in this room. Happy? But how and why? Here, a few feet off, was the janitor, the library man, the stranger. His uniform gone, but his face still the face of a man happier at night alone in the deep marble vaults, whispering his broom in the drafty corridors. Will watched, wondering why this woman was so happy and this man so sad. His father stared deep in the fire, one hand relaxed. Half cupped in that hand lay a crumpled paper ball. Will blinked. He remembered the wind blowing the pale handbill skittering in the trees. Now the same color paper lay crushed, its rococo type hidden in his father's fingers. "Hey!" Will stepped into the parlor. Immediately, Mom opened a smile that was like lighting a second fire. Dad, stricken, looked dismayed, as if caught in a criminal act. Will wanted to say, "Hey, what do you think of the handbill?" But Dad was cramming the handbill deep in the chair upholstery, and Mother was leafing the library books. "Oh, these are fine, Willie." So Will just stood with Cougar and Dark on his tongue and said, "Boy, the wind really flew us home, streets full of paper blowing." Dad didn't flinch at this. "Anything new, Dad?" Dad's hand still lay tucked in the side of the chair. He lifted a gray, slightly worried, very tired gaze to his son. "Stone Lion blew off the library steps. Prowling the town now, looking for Christians. Won't find any. Got the only one in captivity here, and she's a good cook." "Bosh," said Mom. Walking upstairs, Will heard what he half expected to hear. A soft, fluming sigh as something fresh was tossed on the fire. In his mind he saw Dad standing at the hearth, looking down as the paper crinkled to ash. Cougar, Dark, Carnival, Witch, Wonders. He wanted to go back down and stand with Dad, hands out, to be warmed by the fire. Instead, he went slowly up to shut the door of his room. Some nights abed, Will put his ear to the wall to listen. And if his folks talked things that were right, he stayed, and if not right, he turned away. If it was about time and passing years, or himself, or town, or just the general inconclusive way God ran the world, he listened warmly, comfortably, secretly, for it was usually Dad talking. He couldn't often speak with Dad anywhere in the world, inside or out, but this was different. There was a thing in Dad's voice, up, over, down, easy as a hand winging soft in the air, like a white bird describing flight patterns, made the ear want to follow, and the mind's eye to see. And the odd thing in Dad's voice was the sound truth makes being said. The sound of truth in a wild, roving land of city or plain country lies will spell any boy. Many nights Will drowsed this way, his senses like stopped clocks long before that half-singing voice was still. Dad's voice was a midnight school, teaching deep fathom hours, and the subject was life. So it was this night. Will's eyes shut, head leaned to the cool plaster. At first, Dad's voice, a Congo drum, boomed softly, horizons away. Mother's voice, she used her water-bright soprano in the Baptist choir, didn't sing, yet sang back replies. Will imagined Dad sprawled, talking to the empty ceiling.
"Will, makes me feel so old. A man should play baseball with his son."
"Not necessary," said the woman's voice kindly. "You're a good man."
"In a bad season. Hell, I was 40 when he was born. And you?
"Who's your daughter?" people say. God, when you lie down, your thoughts turn to mush. Hell.
Will heard the shift of weight as Dad sat up in the dark. A match was being struck. A pipe was being smoked. The wind rattled the windows.
"Man with posters under his arm.
Carnival," said his mother's voice. "This late in the year?" Will wanted to turn away, but couldn't.
"Most beautiful woman in the world,"
Dad's voice murmured. Mother laughed softly. "You know I'm not." "No," thought Will, "that's from the handbill. Why doesn't Dad tell?" "Because," Will answered himself, "something's going on. Oh, something is going on." Will saw that paper frolicked in the trees, its words the most beautiful woman, and fever prickled his cheeks. He thought Jim, the street of the theater, the naked people in the stage of that theater window, crazy as Chinese opera, darn odd crazy as old Chinese opera, judo, jiu-jitsu, Indian puzzles, and now his father's voice dreaming off, sad, sadder, saddest, much to understand. And suddenly he was scared because Dad wouldn't talk about the handbill he had secretly burned. Will gazed out the window. There, like a milkweed plume, white paper danced in the air. "No," he whispered, "no carnival's coming this late. It can't." He hid under the covers, switched on his flashlight, opened a book. The first picture he saw was a prehistoric reptile trap-drumming a night sky a million years lost. "Heck," he thought, "in the rush I got Jim's book. He's got one of mine." But it was a pretty fine reptile. And flying towards sleep, he thought he heard his father, restless below, the front door shut. His father was going back to work late for no reason, with brooms or books, downtown, away, away. And mother asleep, content, not knowing he had gone. Chapter 9. No one else in the world had a name came so well off the tongue. Jim Nightshade, that's me. Jim stood tall and now lay long in bed, strung together by marsh grass, his bones easy in his flesh easy on his bones. The library books lay unopened by his relaxed right hand. Waiting, his eyes were dark as twilight, with shadows under the eyes from the time, his mother said, he had almost died when he was 3 and still remembered. His hair was dark autumn chestnut, and the veins in his temples and brow and in his neck and ticking in his wrists and on the backs of his slender hands, all these were dark blue. He was marbled with dark, was Jim Nightshade, a boy who talked less and smiled less as the years increased. The trouble with Jim was he looked at the world and could not look away. And when you never look away all your life, by the time you're 13, you have done 20 years taking in the laundry of the world. Will Halloway, it was in him young to always look just beyond, over, or to one side. So at 13, he had saved up only 6 years of staring. Jim knew every centimeter of his shadow, could have cut it out of tar paper, furled it, and run it up a flagpole, his banner. Will, he was occasionally surprised to see his shadow following him somewhere, but that was that. "Jim, you awake?" "Hi, Mom." A door opened and now shut. He felt her weight on the bed. "Why, Jim, your hands are ice. You shouldn't have the window so high. Mind your health." "Sure." "Don't say sure that way. You don't know until you've had 3 children and lost all but one."
"Never going to have any," said Jim.
"You just say that."
"I know it. I know everything."
She waited a moment. "What do you know?"
"No use making more people. People die."
His voice was very calm and quiet and almost sad.
"That's everything."
"Almost everything. You're here, Jim. If you weren't, I'd given up long ago."
"Mom?" A long silence. "Can you remember Dad's face? Do I look like him?"
"The day you go away is the day he leaves forever."
"Who's going away?" Why, just lying there, Jim. You run so fast. I never saw anyone move so much, just sleeping. Promise me, Jim, wherever you go and come back, bring lots of kids. Let them run wild. Let me spoil them some day.
I'm never going to own anything can hurt me.
You going to collect rocks, Jim?
No. Some day you've got to be hurt. No, I don't.
He looked at her. Her face had been hit a long time ago. The bruises had never gone from around her eyes. You'll live and get hurt, she said in the dark. But when it's time, tell me. Say goodbye. Otherwise, I might not let you go. Wouldn't that be terrible to just grab a hold? She rose up suddenly and went to put the window down. Why do boys want their windows open wide?
Warm blood.
Warm blood. She stood alone. That's the story of all our sorrows, and don't ask why. The door shut. Jim, alone, raised the window and leaned into the absolutely clear night.
Storm, he thought, you there?
Yes. Feel, away to the west, a real humdinger rushing along. The shadow of the lightning rod lay on the drive below. He sucked in cold air, gave out a vast exhilaration of heat. Why, he thought, why don't I climb up, knock that lightning rod loose, throw it away, and then see what happens? Yes, and then see what happens.
Chapter 10. Just after midnight. Shuffling footsteps. Along the empty street came the lightning rod salesman, his leather valise swung almost empty in his baseball mitt hand, his face at ease. He turned a corner and stopped. Paper soft white moths tapped at an empty store window, looking in. And in the window, like a great coffin boat of star-colored glass, beached on two sawhorses, lay a chunk of Alaska Snow Company ice chopped to a size great enough to flash in a giant's ring. And sealed in this ice was the most beautiful woman in the world. The lightning rod salesman's smile faded. In the dreaming coldness of ice, like someone fallen and slept in snow avalanches 1,000 years, forever young, was this woman. She was as fair as this morning, and fresh as tomorrow's flowers, and lovely as any maid when a man shuts up his eyes and traps her, in cameo perfection, on the shell of his eyelids. The lightning rod salesman remembered to breathe. Once, long ago, traveling among the marbles of Rome and Florence, he had seen women like this, kept in stone instead of ice. Once wandering in the Louvre, he had found women like this, washed in summer color and kept in paint. Once, as a boy, sneaking the cool grottos behind a motion picture theater screen on his way to a free seat, he had glanced up, and there, towering and flooding the haunted dark, seen a woman's face as he had never seen it since. Of such size and beauty, built of milk bone and moon flesh, as to freeze him there alone behind the stage, shadowed by the motion of her lips, the bird-wing flicker of her eyes, the snow-pale, death-shimmering illumination from her cheeks. So, from other years, there jumped forth images which flowed and found new substance here within the ice. What color was her hair? It was blonde to whiteness, and might take any color once set free of cold. How tall was she? The prism of the ice might well multiply her size, or diminish her, as you moved this way or that before the empty store, the window, the night-soft, rap-tapping, ever-fingering, gently probing moths. Not important. Far above all, the lightning-rod salesman shivered, he knew the most extraordinary thing. If, by some miracle, her eyelids should open within that sapphire and she should look at him, he knew what color her eyes would be. He knew what color her eyes would be. If one were to enter this lonely night shop, if one were to put forth one's hand, the warmth of that hand would...
What? Melt the ice? The lightning rod salesman stood there for a long moment. His eyes quickened shut. He let his breath out. It was warm as summer on his teeth. His hand touched the shop door. It swung open. Cold Arctic air blew out around him. He stepped in. The door shut. The white snowflake moths tapped at the window. Chapter 11. Midnight then, and the town clocks chiming on toward one and two and then three in the deep morning, and the peals of the great clock shaking dust off old toys in high attics, and shedding silver off old mirrors in yet higher attics, and stirring up dreams about clocks in all the beds where children slept. Will heard it. Muffled away in the prairie lands, the chuffing of an engine, the slow following dragon glide of a train. Will sat up in bed. Across the way, like a mirror image, Jim sat up too. A calliope began to play, oh so softly, grieving to itself a million miles away. In one single motion, Will leaned from his window, as did Jim. Without a word, they gazed over the trembling surf of trees. Their rooms were high, as boys' rooms should be. From these gaunt windows they could rifle-fire their gaze artillery distances past library, city hall, depot, cow barns, farmlands, to empty prairie. There on the world's rim the lovely snail gleam of the railway tracks ran, flinging wild gesticulations of lemon or cherry-colored semaphore to the stars. There on the precipice of earth a small steam feather uprose like the first of a storm cloud yet to come. The train itself appeared, link by link, engine, coal car, and numerous and numbered, all asleep and slumbering, dream-filled cars that followed the firefly spark churn, chant, drowsy autumn hearth-fire roar. Hellfires flushed the stunned hills. Even at this remote view, one imagined men with buffalo-haunched arms shoveling black meteor falls of coal into the open boilers of the engine. The engine. Both boys vanished, came back to lift binoculars. The engine! Civil War! No other stack like that since 1900! The rest of the train, all of it's old. The flags, the cages, it's the carnival! They listened. At first, Will thought he heard the air whistling fast in his nostrils, but no, it was the train, and the calliope sighing, weeping on that train. Sounds like church music. Hell, why would a carnival play church music? Don't say hell, hissed Will. Hell, Jim ferociously leaned out. I've saved up all day. Everyone's asleep, so hell. The music drifted by their windows. Goose pimples rose big as boils on Will's arms. That is church music. Changed. For cry, yi, I'm froze. Let's go watch them set up. At 3 a.m.? At 3 a.m. Jim vanished. For a moment, Will watched Jim dance around over there, shirt uplifted, pants going on, while, off in night country, panting, churning, was this funeral train, all black, plumed cars, licorice-colored cages, and a sooty calliope clamoring, banging, three different hymns, mixed and lost, maybe not there at all. Here goes nothing! Jim slid down the drainpipe on his house toward the sleeping lawns. Jim, wait! Will thrashed into his clothes. Jim, don't go alone! And followed after.
This ends Disc 1. Something Wicked This Way Comes. Disc 2.
Chapter 12. Sometimes you see a kite so high, so wise, it almost knows the wind. It travels, then chooses to land in one spot and no other, and no matter how you yank, run this way or that, it will simply break its cord, seek its resting place, and bring you blood-mouthed running.
Jim, wait for me!
So now Jim was the kite, the wild twine cut, and whatever wisdom was his taking him away from Will, who could only run earthbound after one so high and dark, silent, and suddenly strange.
"Jim, here I come!"
And running, Will thought, "Boy, it's the same old thing. I talk, Jim runs. I tilt stones, Jim grabs the cold junk under the stones, and lickety-split. I climb hills, Jim yells off church steeples. I got a bank account, Jim's got the hair on his head, the yell in his mouth, the shirt on his back, and the tennis shoes on his feet. How come I think he's richer?" "Because," Will thought, "I sit on a rock in the sun, and old Jim, he prickles his arm hairs by moonlight and dances with hop toads. I tend cows, Jim tames Gila monsters. Fool," I yell at Jim. "Coward," he yells back, "and here we go." And they ran from town, across fields, and both froze under a rail bridge, with the moon ready beyond the hills, and the meadows trembling with a fur of dew. Wham! The carnival train thundered the bridge. The calliope wailed. "There's no one playing it." Jim stared up. "Jim, no jokes. Mother's honor, look." Going away, away, the calliope pipes shimmered with star explosions, but no one sat at the high keyboard. The wind, sluicing ice-water air in the pipes, made the music. The boys ran. The train curved away, gonging its undersea funeral bell, sunk, rusted, green-mossed, tolling, tolling. Then the engine whistle blew a great steam whiff, and Will broke out in pearls of ice. Way late at night, Will had heard, how often, train whistles jetting steam along the rim of sleep. Forlorn, alone and far, no matter how near they came. Sometimes he woke to find tears on his cheek, asked why, lay back, listened, and thought, "Yes, they make me cry, going east, going west, the trains of far gone in country deeps they drown in tides of sleep that escape the towns." Those trains and their grieving sounds were lost forever between stations, not remembering where they had been, not guessing where they might go, exhaling their last pale breaths over the horizon. Gone. So it was with all trains, ever. Yet this train's whistle. The wails of a lifetime were gathered in it from other nights in other slumbering years. The howl of moon-dream dogs, the seep of river-cold winds through January porch screens which stopped the blood, 1,000 fire sirens weeping, or worse. The outgone shreds of breath, the protests of 1 billion people dead or dying, not wanting to be dead, their groans, their sighs, burst over the earth. Tears jumped to Will's eyes. He lurched, he knelt, he pretended to lace one shoe. But then he saw Jim's hands clap his ears, his eyes wet too. The whistle screamed. Jim screamed against the scream. The whistle shrieked. Will shrieked against the shriek. Then the 1 billion voices ceased, instantly, as if the train had plunged in a firestorm off the earth. The train skimmed on softly, slithering, black pennants fluttering, black confetti lost on its own sick sweet candy wind. Down the hill, with the boys pursuing, the air so cold they ate ice cream with each breath. They climbed, a last rise, to look down. "Boy," whispered Jim. The train had pulled off into Rolfe's Moon Meadow, so called because town couples came out to see the moonrise here over a land so wide, so long, it was like an inland sea filled with grass in spring or hay in late summer or snow in winter. It was fine, walking here along its crisp shore, with the moon coming up to tremble in its tides. Well, the carnival train was crouched there now in the autumn grass on the old rail spur near the woods, and the boys crept and lay down under a bush, waiting. "It's so quiet," whispered Will. The train just stood in the middle of the dry autumn field. No one in the locomotive, no one in the tender, no one in any of the cars behind, all black under the moon, and just the small sounds of its metal cooling, ticking on the rails. "St," said Jim. I feel them moving in there.
Will felt the cat fuzz on his body bramble up by the thousands.
You think they mind us watching?
Maybe, said Jim happily.
Then why the noisy calliope?
When I figure that, Jim smiled, I'll tell you.
Look. Whisper.
As if exhaling itself straight down from the sky, a vast moss-green balloon touched at the moon. It hovered 200 yards above and away, quietly riding the wind.
The basket under the balloon. Someone in it.
But then a tall man stepped down from the train caboose platform like a captain, assaying the tidal weathers of this inland sea. All dark suit, shadow-faced, he waded to the center of the meadow, his shirt as black as the gloved hands he now stretched to the sky. He gestured once, and the train came to life. At first, a head lifted in one window, then an arm, then another head like a puppet in a marionette theater. Suddenly, two men in black were carrying a dark tent pole out across the hissing grass. It was the silence that made Will pull back, even as Jim leaned forward, eyes moon bright. A carnival should be all growls, roars like timberland stacked, bundled, rolled, and crashed, great explosions of lion dust, men ablaze with working anger, pop bottles jangling, horse buckles shivering, engines and elephants in full stampede through rains of sweat, while zebras neighed and trembled like cage trapped in cage. But this was like old movies. The silent theater, haunted with black and white ghosts, silvery mouths opening to let moonlight smoke out, gestures made in silence so hushed you could hear the wind fizz the hair on your cheeks. More shadows rustled from the train, passing the animal cages, where darkness prowled with unlit eyes, and the calliope stood mute, save for the faintest idiot tune the breeze piped wandering up the flues. The ringmaster stood in the middle of the land. The balloon, like a vast, moldy green cheese, stood fixed to the sky. Then darkness came. The last thing Will saw was the balloon swooping down, as clouds covered the moon. In the night he felt the men rush to unseen tasks. He sensed the balloon like a great fat spider fiddling with the lines and poles, rearing a tapestry in the sky. The clouds arose. The balloon sifted up. In the meadow stood the skeleton main poles and wires of the main tent, waiting for its canvas skin. More clouds poured over the white moon. Shadowed, Will shivered. He heard Jim crawling forward, seized his ankle, felt him stiffen.
"Wait," said Will. "They're bringing out the canvas."
"No," said Jim. "Oh, no." For somehow, instead, they both knew the wires, high flung on the poles, were catching swift clouds, ripping them free from the wind in streamers which, stitched and sewn by some great monster shadow, made canvas and more canvas as the tent took shape. At last, there was the clear water sound of vast flags blowing. The motion stopped. The darkness within darkness was still. Will lay, eyes shut, hearing the beat of great oil-black wings, as if a huge ancient bird had drummed down to live, to breathe, to survive in the night meadow. The clouds blew away. The balloon was gone. The men were gone. The tents rippled like black rain on their poles. Suddenly, it seemed a long way to town. Instinctively, Will glanced behind himself. Nothing but grass and whispers. Slowly he looked back at the silent, dark, seemingly empty tents. "I don't like it," he said. Jim couldn't tear his eyes away. "Yeah," he whispered. "Yeah." Will stood up. Jim lay on the earth.
"Jim?" said Will.
Jim jerked his head as if slapped. He was on his knees. He swayed up.
His body turned, but his eyes were fastened to those black flags, the great sideshow signs swarming with unguessed wings, horns, and demon smiles. A bird screamed. Jim jumped. Jim gasped. Cloud shadows panicked them over the hills to the edge of town. From there, the two boys ran alone. Chapter 13. The air was cold, blowing in through the wide-open library window. Charles Halloway had stood there for a long time. Now he quickened. Along the street below fled two shadows, two boys above the matching shadows, stride for stride. They softly printed the night air with treads.
"Jim!" cried the old man. "Will!"
But not aloud. The boys went away toward home. Charles Halloway looked out into the country. Wandering alone in the library, letting his broom tell him things no one else could hear, he had heard the whistle and the disjointed calliope hymns. "Three," he now said half aloud, "three in the morning." In the meadow, the tents, the carnival waited for someone, anyone, to wade along the grassy surf. The great tents filled like bellows. They softly issued forth exhalations of air that smelled like ancient yellow beasts. But only the moon looked in at the hollow dark, the deep caverns. Outside, night beasts hung in mid-gallop on a carousel.
Beyond lay fathoms of mirror maze, which housed a multifold series of empty vanities, one wave on another, still, serene, silvered with age, white with time.
Any shadow at the entrance might stir reverberations the color of fright, unravel deep buried moons. If a man stood here, would he see himself unfolded away a billion times to eternity? Would a billion images look back, each face and the face after that, old, older, oldest? Would he find himself lost in a fine dust away off deep down there, not 50 but 60, not 60 but 70, not 70 but 80, 90, 99 years old? The maze didn't ask. The maze didn't tell. It simply stood and waited like a great Arctic floe.
3 o'clock.
Charles Halloway was cold. His skin was suddenly a lizard's skin, his stomach filled with blood turned to rust. His mouth tasted of night damps, yet he couldn't turn from the library window. Far off, something glittered in the meadow. It was moonlight flashing on a great glass. Perhaps the light said something. Perhaps it spoke in code. "I'll go there," thought Charles Halloway. "I won't go there." "I like it," he thought. "I don't like it." A moment later, the library door slammed. Going home, he passed the empty store window. Inside stood two abandoned sawhorses. Between lay a pool of water. In the water floated a few shards of ice. In the ice were a few long strands of hair.
Charles Halloway saw, but chose not to see. He turned and was gone. The street was soon as empty as the hardware store window.
Far away, in the meadow, shadows flickered in the mirror maze, as if parts of someone's life, yet unborn, were trapped there, waiting to be lived. So the maze waited, its cold gaze ready for so much as a bird to come look, see, and fly away shrieking. But no bird came. Chapter 14. 3, a voice said. Will listened, cold but warming, glad to be in with a roof above, floor below, wall and door between too much exposure, too much freedom, too much night. 3. Dad's voice, home now, moving down the hall, speaking to itself. 3. Why, thought Will, that's when the train came. Had Dad seen, heard, followed? No, he mustn't. Will hunched himself. Why not? He trembled. What did he fear? The carnival, rushing in like a black stampede of storm waves on the shore out beyond? Of him and Jim and Dad knowing? Of the town asleep, not knowing? Was that it? Yes, Will buried himself deep. Yes. 3 in the morning, thought Charles Halloway, seated on the edge of his bed. Why did the train come at that hour? 4, he thought, it's a special hour. Women never wake then, do they? They sleep the sleep of babes and children, but men in middle age, they know that hour well. Oh, God, midnight's not bad. You wake and go back to sleep. 1 or 2's not bad. You toss, but sleep again. 5 or 6 in the morning, there's hope, for dawn's just under the horizon. But 3 now, Christ, 3 a.m. Doctors say the body's at low tide then. The soul is out, the blood moves slow. You're the nearest to dead you'll ever be, save dying. Sleep is a patch of death. But 3 in the morn, full wide-eyed staring, is living death. You dream with your eyes open. God, if you had strength to rouse up, you'd slaughter your half-dreams with buckshot. But no, you lie pinned to a deep well bottom that's burned dry. The moon rolls by to look at you down there with its idiot face. It's a long way back to sunset, a far way on to dawn, so you summon all the fool things of your life, the stupid lovely things done with people known so very well who are now so very dead. And wasn't it true? Had he read it somewhere? More people in hospitals die at 3 a.m. than at any other time? Stop, he cried silently. Charlie, his wife said in her sleep. Slowly he took off the other shoe. His wife smiled in her sleep. Why? She's immortal. She has a son. Your son, too. But what father ever really believes it? He carries no burden, he feels no pain. What man, like woman, lies down in darkness and gets up with child? The gentle, smiling ones own the good secret. Oh, what strange, wonderful clocks women are. They nest in time, they make the flesh that holds fast and binds eternity. They live inside the gift, no power, except, and need not mention it. Why speak of time when you are time, and shape the universal moments as they pass into warmth and action? How men envy and often hate these warm clocks, these wives who know they will live forever. So what do? We men turn terribly mean, because we can't hold to the world, or ourselves, or anything. We are blind to continuity. All breaks down, falls, melts, stops, rots, or runs away. So, since we cannot shape time, where does that leave men? Sleepless, staring. 3 a.m. That's our reward. 3 in the morn. The soul's midnight. The tide goes out, the soul ebbs, and a train arrives at an hour of despair. Why? Charlie. His wife's hand moved to his. You all right, Charlie? She drowsed. He didn't answer. He could not tell her how he was. Chapter 15. The sun rose yellow as a lemon. The sky was round and blue. The birds looped clear water songs in the air. Will and Jim leaned from their windows. Nothing had changed, except the look in Jim's eyes. Last night, said Will, did or didn't it happen? They both gazed toward the far meadows. The air was sweet as syrup. They could find no shadows anywhere, even under trees. 6 minutes, cried Jim. 5! 4 minutes later, cornflakes lurching in their stomachs, they frisked the leaves to a fine red dust going out of town. With a wild flutter of breath, they raised their eyes from the earth they had been treading. And the carnival was there. Hey! for the tents were lemon like the sun, brass like wheat fields a few weeks ago, flags and banners bright as bluebirds snapped above lion-colored canvas. From booths painted cotton candy colors, fine Saturday smells of bacon and eggs, hot dogs and pancakes swam the wind. Everywhere ran boys. Everywhere sleepy fathers followed. "It's just a plain old carnival," said Will.
"Like heck," said Jim. "We weren't blind last night. Come on."
They marched 100 yards straight on and deep into the midway, and the deeper they went, the more obvious it became they would find no nightmen cat-treading balloon shadow while strange tents plumed like thunderclouds. Instead, close up, the carnival was mildewed rope, moth-eaten canvas, rain-worn, sun-bleached tinsel. The sideshow paintings hung like sad albatrosses on their poles, flapped and let fall flakes of ancient paint, shivering and at the same time revealing the unwondrous wonders of a thin man, fat man, needlehead, tattooed man, hula dancer. They prowled on but found no mysterious midnight spheres of evil gas tied by mysterious oriental knots to daggers plunged in dark earth. No maniac ticket-takers bent on terrible revenges. The calliope by the ticket booth neither screamed deaths nor hummed idiot songs to itself. The train pulled off on a spur in the warming grass. It was old, yes, and welded tight with rust, but it looked like a titanic magnet that had collected to itself from locomotive boneyards across 3 continents, drive shafts, flywheels, smokestacks, and hand-me-down second-rate nightmares. It didn't cut a black and mortuary silhouette. It asked permission but to lie dead in autumn strewings, so much tired steam and iron gunpowder blowing away.
"Jim? Will?"
Here came Miss Foley, their 7th-grade schoolteacher along the midway, all smiles.
"Boys," she said,
"what's wrong? You look as if you lost something."
"Well," said Will, "last night, did you hear that calliope?"
"Calliope? No."
"Then why are you out here so early, Miss Foley?" asked Jim.
"I love carnivals,"
said Miss Foley, a little woman lost somewhere in her gray 50s, beaming around.
"I'll buy hot dogs, and you eat while I look for my fool nephew. You seen him?"
"Nephew?"
"Robert, staying with me a few weeks. Father's dead, mother's sick in Wisconsin. I took him in. He ran out here early today, said he'd meet me, but you know boys."
"My, you look glum." She shoved food at them.
"Eat. Cheer up. Rides'll open in 10 minutes. Meantime, I think I'll spy through that mirror maze and—"
"No," said Will.
"No what?"
asked Miss Foley. "No mirror maze." Will swallowed. He stared at fathoms of reflections. You could never strike bottom there. It was like winter standing tall, waiting to kill you with a glance. "Miss Foley," he said at last, and wondered to hear his mouth say it, "don't go in there."
"Why not?"
Jim peered fascinated into Will's face.
"Yeah, tell us, why not?"
"People get lost,"
said Will lamely.
"All the more reason. Robert might be wandering loose and not find his way out if I don't grab his ear."
"Never can tell."
Will couldn't take his eyes off the millions of miles of blind glass.
"What might be swimming around in there?"
"Swimming?"
Miss Foley laughed.
"What a lovely mind you have, Willie. Well, yes, but I'm an old fish, so—"
"Miss Foley!"
Miss Foley waved, poised, took a step, and vanished into the mirror ocean. They watched as she settled, wandered, sank deep, deep, and was finally dissolved, gray among silver. Jim grabbed Will.
"What was all that?"